Hi, I'm Lauren Weymouth, leading the University Blockchain Research Initiative, UBRI, for Ripple, and your host of All About Blockchain. We continue to bring blockchain use cases that solve problems to make a difference in our lives across various sectors, uncovering what is possible with this tech and where it's going to take us in the next 3 to 5 years. We do this by interviewing academic and entrepreneurial partners who are building meaningful projects on-chain. Now, as this summer is entirely too hot everywhere, it's time to dive further into sustainability. We're excited to discuss carbon markets and ways to address climate change. I've asked my friend and colleague, Peter Rosberg in San Francisco, to lead this discussion, and you'll hear why. Peter's been in Silicon Valley startup scene for over 30 years, working for companies in crypto, lending, fintech, and e-commerce. Now with Ripple Engineering, he's building products with partners to mitigate climate change, encourage ecological and technical project development, and support the United Nations sustainability goals. Peter will be interviewing our guest, Ando Shah, PhD candidate in the Information Science Department at UC Berkeley. Peter, let's jump in.
Thank you, Lauren. Today, we're live at Ripple headquarters in downtown San Francisco with Ando Shah, an experienced designer, systems engineer, and virtual reality pioneer. Ando focuses on financing biodiversity and climate-positive interventions. He's currently working on a project, Decentralized Framework for Accurate and Consistent Carbon Pricing. Ando, welcome to All About Blockchain.
Thanks, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for coming into our offices today. Are you based in Berkeley?
I am, yes.
What drew you to information science and working with Professor John Chang?
I've been in the industry for about 15 years before I went back to grad school. And I was at a place in life where my previous baby, the company that I started, was doing well. And sort of my mission in life had deviated a little bit from the trajectory of the company. And I wanted to go back and explore the things that were really important to me. And I felt like doing a PhD where you get the sort of space and the time to think deeply and develop things at depth that can have potential impact was quite high. The School of Information at Berkeley is a kind of a weird, wacky place because we study anything that has to do with information, which in today's world is, you know, everything. So it allowed me that sort of the horizon to explore and be able to apply technology to social environmental good, but also look at the harms of technology and where we can find a good balance between all of these systems that interact.
Before we talk about your project, could you give our listeners a high-level description of how the voluntary ecological markets work?
You could make an argument that the voluntary carbon markets are actually part of the voluntary ecological markets, although the ecological aspect of it is much more wide-ranging. Carbon is addressing a very, very specific need, which is the need to remove carbon from the atmosphere, right? Which is very, very directly related to the carbon crisis, the climate crisis, essentially. But there are many aspects of the climate crisis that carbon does not address. There is sort of a triple threat right now to ecosystems, to the climate, as well as to societies around the world. And just applying the lens of carbon is reductive and is not going to get us all the way there. So we have to look at it in terms of how we can protect and restore ecosystems, which is keeping the balance on the planet in a healthy way. If you look at the numbers in what is required to protect and restore ecosystems and what funding is being allocated to them, there's close to a $1 trillion gap on a yearly basis on what's needed. So there is a sore need for funding for ecosystems to be protected and preserved. And so the voluntary ecological market is an attempt to do that and is an attempt to extend the carbon crediting mechanism to also to biodiversity. And that's sort of the very high level view. And as we get closer to the ground, what's happening now is the Kunming-Montreal Biodiversity Framework, which was arrived at last year, which was agreed to by almost all countries in the world. We decided together to provide funding for the protection of ecosystems. So things like payment for ecosystem services, green bonds, biodiversity offsets, and credits. So that is now paving the way for an actual financial ecological market to exist. And early work has started. There's a few companies that have started producing these credits, but it's very, very tiny right now and a small percentage of its potential.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, everybody, when you think about sustainability, thinks about the carbon markets, but there's so many other things that are going on and so many other things that need to be preserved, like biodiversity in the ocean. The United Nations has a list of 17 sustainable development goals. These are goals like no poverty, climate action, clean water, life on land. How does what you just described with the voluntary ecological markets relate to these UN SDGs?
So one way to look at how these markets are evolving is sort of an attempt to internalize all the externalities of the global capitalist system. And so what I mean by externalities is sort of the negative outcomes that are not being priced for within the system. So when factories pollute or supply chains have leakages or what have you, it's not just the addition of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. It's also a degradation of natural ecosystems, pollution in the ocean, in rivers, and so forth. So now the attempt is to kind of create this modular crediting systems where carbon is sort of one of the blocks. And then you can have other blocks that are responding to threats to biodiversity, threats to social cohesion. Things like plastic pollution could be very specific sort of crediting mechanisms. So somebody could get paid for cleaning up the plastic in certain areas. These could also provide incentives for companies that are heavily reliant on plastic products and plastic outputs to switch to sustainable alternatives. So this sort of stackability of this crediting system can enable some of the funding gaps to be filled that then go towards projects that can provide the incentives to have this transition. And how it relates to the SDGs is, you know, like you were mentioning, Peter, you know, the SDG 3 is like good health and well-being, 6 is clean water and sanitation, 13 is climate action, life below water is 14, and so forth. And so all of these need to be addressed, not just at a framework level where the UN says, hey, this stuff needs to happen, but also at an action level, which is already happening. Communities are rallying around these causes and creating very impactful projects, but they also need the financing for us to backstop these and also to enable them to continue in a sustainable way into the future. So I think that's how where the rubber meets the road.
Tell us about the current problem you're looking at and how you're trying to solve it.
My personal sort of ethos is around working on problems relating to the global commons. So the global commons are essentially parts of the world which nobody really owns, but has massive benefits and effects on the rest of the world. So an example of that would be the atmosphere. Nobody really owns the atmosphere, but we're all part of it. We breathe it. We also pollute it. And it is a shared responsibility. The oceans, the rivers, our protected lands, these are all global commons. And there's a famous term that is called the tragedy of the commons, which is the idea that because we don't own the commons and there's no actual responsibility for them, we don't actually end up taking care of them. And the global commons are extremely important in, you know, how we deal with living on this planet going forward and how we've always taken care of it. And so some of the problems that I'm looking at is like, okay, how can we try to restore the balance to the global commons? One of the projects is working around protecting large oceanic areas, so marine protected areas. One of the projects is working with the government of Costa Rica, which has established one of the world's largest marine protected areas. And this is in the order of hundreds of thousands of square kilometers of open ocean, which is very hard to patrol, very hard to understand and study, let alone protect. And it requires a lot of funding for a relatively small developing nation to undertake. So we wanted to create a sort of framework, a first pass, if you will, at building a crediting mechanism that can help them finance the continued protection of the ocean. Another project that I'm working on deals with illegal and unsustainable mining across the world. And there's a big one around sand mining. Sand is an essential ingredient in concrete and asphalt, especially in the global south where infrastructure projects consume so much concrete. And all the sand basically comes from beaches and rivers, which are the global commons. And the beaches and rivers are being degraded at an incredible rate today that has huge repercussions on society, both locally as well as the world globally. We're looking at ways of monitoring and creating policy around ameliorating some of these harms. Another one is looking at carbon pricing in the context of corporations. And carbon pricing is a very important mechanism in the corporate net zero movement. Carbon pricing, simply put, is a way to internally price carbon dioxide as part of the operation of the organization. So just as how we would price goods and services, we also need to price carbon dioxide. So there is an internal incentive to be able to reduce the carbon footprint of organizations.
That's fascinating. In terms of like your monitoring and the tracking of prices, how can blockchain play a role in that? What are your thoughts on how blockchain solves that problem or does it?
I think the jury is still out. Part of the solutions that we envisioned were to sort of bring on these complicated carbon pricing models. They call the integrated assessment models, and what they produce are the social cost of carbon. And the social cost of carbon is simply put a way to price the emission of 1 ton of carbon dioxide to society at large, meaning it has to take into account what that ton of carbon dioxide does in the atmosphere over the next few hundred years. What does it do to ecosystems around the world? What does it do to livelihoods? What does it do to the ways in which we produce and consume value in the world? Which is, as you can imagine, a very complex undertaking. And so a lot of research organizations, also at UC Berkeley, have produced some of the leading models for carbon pricing, for social cost of carbon. It's sort of the cutting edge in the most equitable forms of carbon pricing. Traditionally, how carbon pricing is done is mostly market-based systems. For example, the European emissions trading system is semi-regulated by the European Union, and the voluntary carbon market is entirely market-based, so it's a supply-demand curve that's being solved. But it doesn't take into account what the true price of carbon is, right? So what are all the costs associated with the emission of carbon dioxide? So the social cost of carbon does that, and our idea was that we need to start looking at the hard truths about carbon emissions. And one of the ways to do that would be to bring these models to organizations that actually need to start pricing carbon internally. These models, however, are very complex. They're very opaque. They're all open source, but I would encourage, you know, our more technically minded listeners to try and run some of these. But they require a lot of understanding of how these models work under the hood to be able to parameterize them, because there are dozens of parameters that vastly modulate the outcome value. These models exist, but they're not very well used outside of, say, governments saying, oh, this is a price that we believe in, or the UN saying this is what the price should be. So they're not actually operationalized to a large extent. We wanted to change that, try to operationalize these. And so we brought some of these models online. We, you know, gave them an interface, and so anybody can go in and play with the parameters, and the education on how to use the system is built into the user interface. So this is already live, and we can post links to that later. And we want to take that a step further and A, give these to organizations that could use them, and then also be able to track what they're doing with them, right? We wanted to store not just the value that's being picked. The price of carbon that we'll pick will be $110. The model says so, but also the inputs to the model, which represent the ethical framework that the organization is vested in. So for example, one of the most important parameters in the calculating the social cost of carbon is called the discount rate. And the discount rate within these models determines how much of the lifetime cost of the carbon that you're emitting is the emitter paying versus society at large paying in the future. What that implies is that how much do we value future generations? How much do we value the human society and the ecology at large? If the organization takes 100% responsibility for all their emissions, then it implies that perhaps they have different ethics than somebody who doesn't. So there are ethical parameters within these models. So we wanted to be able to track all of these and in a transparent way. So that's where a distributed ledger becomes really valuable, to be able to track these over time across space, across organizations, and see what different organizations are doing. Sorry, that's a very long-winded way of answering your question.
There's lots to unpack there too, you know, like just the concept of being able to take future generations into account, and what's the discounted rate of a future person 50 years out versus 25 years out. And I'd love to just jump down that rabbit hole, but I think that's probably a different discussion. That's fascinating, just taking all that into account and the price of carbon, and just how little of it is actually taken into account today when you've got a $15 carbon credit, when it's really $3,000 worth of societal damage. How did you get into blockchain? What made you get interested in blockchain to begin with in terms of this project?
I think my interest in blockchain is around very specific characteristics of the underlying technology, which is the decentralized aspect and the transparency aspect and what they can enable. In general, I work with a bunch of buzzword technologies, blockchain, AI, et cetera, and not because they're the coolest things, although, you know, in all honesty, they do tend to attract funding, but they all provide something that's useful. So I try to distill them to their essence that can provide value to a project, and I try to use it for what that use is. So in this case, using a distributed ledger and actually allowing a smart contract to be able to interact with the system was what attracted me to this. And the idea of sort of an algorithmic price setting mechanism. We have all of these net zero pledges and emissions reduction pledges. And if you just look at the history, like nobody's meeting their pledges. They're very, very far from it. So can we pressurize organizations to actually meet their pledges in an algorithmic way? Can we bake it into a smart contract where there are actual repercussions to not meeting your pledges? This is, you know, very optimistic thinking. I don't think many organizations will actually sign up for it, but I think as an experiment, it's a valuable thing to try to conduct and see what could happen and at least open the doors to this sort of thinking. And so a smart contract could enable an increasing schedule of prices, for example. You know, like you mentioned, the actual price of carbon is something like $3,000. Nobody's going to pay $3,000 a ton of carbon today. But if they're okay with starting at even $10, $20, $50 a ton, but you can say, hey, let's put policy in place or social pressure in place where you need to sign up for an increasing schedule of prices. And let's bake that into a smart contract. So here's where all of this stuff can kind of start fitting together and making sense.
Climate and sustainability, I'd say, is also a pretty big buzzword, very important buzzword. What first got your interest in moving into the climate and ecological space?
So I've sort of been in the climate adjacent space for a long time. I did a startup in Angaza where we were trying to make solar energy more affordable to the people of East Africa.
You spent so much of your life looking at sustainability and been adjacent to all the climate science and blue carbon in the ocean. On your current project, what other groups and organizations are you working with to accomplish your goals? What collaborations are you doing? Because it's complicated, right? You're trying to do carbon pricing and figure out how these complex models work. You can't do that by yourself. So who else are you working with?
On the carbon pricing side, we've been very lucky because at Berkeley, there's some of the top environmental economists work in practice there, and they're the ones who've built these models. So we had like full access to the people who wrote the code and devised the equations and all that. I'm very, very far from an expert in environmental economics, and you know, they really handheld us through the process of how to actually use these models, how to parameterize them, so that we could do the translation of, hey, how can we allow this to be used by a layperson online on a web interface, and then translate that into what corporations need. So right now we're in the process of interviewing a lot of ESG practitioners in different organizations, mostly Fortune 500 companies, consultants that work with Fortune 500 companies to build out their net zero programs and strategies and carbon pricing strategies to really understand where the roadblocks are for equitable carbon pricing, where the roadblocks are for adopting new mechanisms, which is not just reactive to what your competitors are doing or what policy requires you to do. And also in some ways try to influence policy that enables all of these. So I think on one side, there's, I would say, you know, deep engagement with corporates. There's engagement with academics that's required to operationalize all of these. On some of the other projects, like, for example, the sand mining one, where we're basically looking at satellite images across the world and detecting and using machine learning to detect where illegal and unregulated sand mining is happening at large scales. The hope is to try to inform local organizations to take action on that, inform local governments, local civil society, and so forth. So over there, we're working with smaller nonprofits in South Asia. We're working with the Global Sand Observatory, which is at the United Nations Environmental Program. So, you know, multilateral organizations, small NGOs, other academics. I'm really the person who's trying to string together these expertise and create a cohesive whole where they can interact in a meaningful way.
That's a great point on the monitoring and helping local governments enforce the sound ecological practices. There has been negative press lately about some of these projects. There was a recent piece in The Guardian on forestry projects. Are they really additional? For those of you that aren't in the sustainability space, additionality means would this project have happened without the additional funding? Am I paying some government that was going to preserve a forest anyway, or am I paying to support a project that wouldn't have been sequestering carbon had I not been there to support it? What kind of monitoring systems are in place to help show that? What are some of the other ways this can be addressed, like with market pressures, for example, pricing? What are your thoughts on ways to address this?
That's a great question, Peter. And I'm going to start out by saying something slightly controversial, which is that I think additionality or the value of additionality in my mind is quite context specific. I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with paying a government to continue protecting a very valuable ecosystem. For example, the Amazon, which is under incredible threat today and requires a lot of support from outside of Brazil and outside of the Amazonian countries to continue its protection. But I think there's a lot of nuance in there. These are very wide, large examples. And I want to get into some of the nuances. So let's zoom out from carbon a little bit. Let's go into the greater aspects of why we should do this in the first place, right? So carbon is a very clear answer. We should do this because we've put out too much carbon in the atmosphere, and we're going to probably continue to do that at a detrimental rate, and we have to offset that somehow. Fine, great. If I go out there and I chop down pristine rainforest and replace that with a timber plantation, which is basically eradicating all of the value of that ecosystem provided, not just to us, but to all non-human entities, to things that are very, very hard to quantify, including things like the global climatic system and how changes in the Amazon and the Sahara dust systems affect winds and rainfall and what have you across the world. These are very, very complex things to determine at a global scale for local changes. If you look at something like biodiversity, we've become fairly familiar with the word biodiversity, but there isn't a good working definition yet for this. The person who is really responsible for coining this term and making it popular is a very famous biologist by the name of E.O. Wilson. And he said, biodiversity is the totality of hereditary variation in life forms across all levels of biological organization. Good luck translating that into a credit. You know, if you talk about additionality in biodiversity, what does that mean? Does that mean that we increase the number of the plants that were growing there, the number of species of insects and birds and reptiles? Is it the total number of individuals? Is it the variation of genetic diversity? Like, there are so many different definitions, and how do you come up with that and build a unit off of it? With carbon, it's still hard, but it's relatively easy to say a unit of carbon is a ton of carbon dioxide equivalent. And we can measure that. You know, we have models of, be like, this tree has this much carbon dioxide. The root system and the soil system has this much carbon dioxide. All of that stuff is not completely worked out, but we are very far along. In biodiversity, we've been struggling with this for a long time. We're going to continue to struggle with this, but it's an important conversation to have and push forward. So there are situations where I think additionality constraints should not be enforced. There is a division now between this idea of protection and restoration credit. So if you have an ecosystem that's very degraded, and the owners of the land, whether it's a government or a private entity, they have the wherewithal to be like, I want to get paid to restore that ecosystem, I think that's a very, very good case for additionality. There's another scenario where, take the example of the marine protected area in Costa Rica. It is incredibly difficult and incredibly expensive to continue maintaining that marine protected area, because it's not just that area. It's providing breeding grounds for hammerhead sharks and hawksbill turtles that go to other countries and provide other services. It allows the fish stock in the entire eastern Pacific Ocean to actually be healthy, so that the food that is being consumed by the population of that entire coastline can also be preserved in a sustainable way. But these things are not priced into the price of fish that one pays in those markets. So the government of Costa Rica wants to raise funding to be able to continue the protection. So I think the thing to do is rigorously evaluate not just what the outcomes of the protection are, but also what are the efforts that are being put in. Because there are other externalities that can come in and completely dilute your efforts. So for example, you know, we can verify through satellite images, through reports, through sensors, okay, things are actually happening. Patrols are happening. Illegal fishing is being stopped. Da, da, da. Things are happening. But the ocean continues to absorb carbon dioxide because we're releasing excess amounts of carbon dioxide. And that is acidifying the ocean, that is bleaching coral reefs, that is making it harder for crustaceans to grow and thrive. It is making it harder for species to migrate and so forth. And all of this is going to reduce the biodiversity in an area, even though you do all the protection in the world. So that needs to be accounted for in certain ways in that very specific example. And I think all these nuances exist. So I think we have to be very careful about applying these sort of hard lines. And we have to think about like the sort of greater repercussions within these complex interconnected systems.
That's a great point. In the carbon world, you have this concept of you're setting a baseline. So you analyze what the baseline is. And then from there, you start calculating additionality and other aspects that prove that CO2 is being sequestered. Then if I go off and I have a rubber tree plantation, it's not really accomplishing anything other than that very specific thing of, sure, I'm doing really good agroforestry on a monolithic crop of rubber trees, right? It's not what we want to do. And so trying to figure out how you can capture some of those other aspects, or what in the sustainability world is called co-benefits to that carbon sequestration, with proving the biodiversity and proving the baseline of that biodiversity is now higher. It's very early days. People joke about counting salamanders and stuff because it's just like, you know, there's literally microphones hanging in forests counting bird calls. How do you prove that? But it's something we got to figure out, right? Because it's not just about sequestering the carbon. It's also about where 14% of our species are going away.
Out of the millions of species that we don't even know about at this point. Yeah. And this is where the stacking model becomes really interesting, right? Where we're not knocking on carbon. We're not knocking on additionality. I think these are very, very important things to keep into account. But here's where we can say, all right, the carbon is important. We will provide the financial incentives for that. Let's also stack on the biodiversity. Let us evaluate not just the market price, but also the true price of biodiversity is within these markets. We can stack on social credits. What is it doing for the local indigenous population? How is it helping them? Are we going into eco-colonialism? Are we just grabbing land and providing incentives for large companies to come in and get these carbon credits and depriving the local population of their sacred lands and their heritage? I think we have to innovate in these fields to make all of these work.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, eco-colonialism is a huge issue, and being able to actually work properly with indigenous populations is super important for projects. If you end up hurting people in the process of trying to preserve the environment, what are you really accomplishing? What other challenges are out there? What other challenges exist that you're trying to address?
I think one of the big challenges, which was not particularly big surprise, was that when we were in the process of speaking to corporations about incorporating the social cost of carbon, at least within their models of carbon pricing, I mean, the first thing that was evident is that there are so few companies that are even gone past the idea of operationalizing their net zero pledge. You know, firstly, net zero pledge, or even reduction of emissions pledges. Then there's a question of operationalizing them. What are the tools that you use to operationalize them? One of them is carbon pricing. Who's actually making changes? And there are so few large organizations that are doing this. When you introduce this idea of, hey, this is our best idea of the true price of carbon, they look at the number and they're like, this is 700% the value of what we think the price of carbon is. So it's a non-starter, right? So then the question becomes, how can we make this a starter? So then our idea is, okay, can we incentivize organizations to use the social cost of carbon as a benchmark, as something to aspire towards? You know, at least it's in their horizon, in their vision. These are markets where there isn't regulation around carbon pricing, like the European trading system that, you know, European Union organizations have to adhere to. The challenges are like getting these carrots and sticks in a configuration that provides enough incentive without robbing enough value, so there isn't enough backlash. The whole carbon pricing space is very fraught with the potentiality of both harm and benefit that can be derived from it, which I don't feel particularly adequately equipped to deal with. So I think I'm just learning so much as I speak to people in this space. I think those have been some of the big surprises for me. One other challenge that I think is more at an ethical level that I face personally is this idea of trying to put a monetary value on nature. It's kind of our only way of mashing it into the economic system and the economic model that the world has adopted essentially at large, you know, almost without exception. And it seems like there's no way out of this. But I think there's value to thinking about alternative ways towards protecting nature and having this balance between human activities and what the biomes across the world need, and also integrating ourselves more within nature and not being so separate from nature. And a lot of this stuff is going to sound woo-woo, but it's part of the larger considerations the human race kind of has to start dealing with over the next few centuries. Otherwise, you know, it's kaput.
Yeah, for sure. And that is a big struggle in the industry itself. You know, there's the people that are saying the only valid way to deal with this issue is for me to be tracking as a company my emissions and my supply chain emissions and my employee emissions. And I should be laser focused on reducing those emissions and allowing people to buy carbon credits and to put dollar values on sequestering carbon is the wrong way to go about it. We just need to be better. But for me as a capitalist, I also recognize, look, money is a huge motivator. If I can get a company that can't get rid of all their emissions, I mean, they should try to get rid of all their emissions first, right? But if they can't get rid of all their emissions, allowing them to take it, their money and spend it to offset the rest to finance these projects that are also sequestering, I think is valuable to the industry at large, and it's going to jumpstart a lot of projects. Totally understand that that's a difficult balance between the two different sides of what we're trying to accomplish here. It was also interesting, I was hearing in there a lot of what Ripple's been going through and many large companies have been going through in a corporate evolution, right? So, you know, XRPL, that's been energy efficient from the beginning. What little carbon it produces, we now offset with renewable energy, RECs. So that's 100% carbon neutral. Ripple as a company, we've started offsetting what our employees do, either by reducing our emissions, exposing that to our employees. They see just how impactful the plane flight may be, for example. But now I think we've hit that next level of a corporation where we're like, okay, we need to be more active. We've started up this $100 million sustainability fund where we're actually investing in projects. And we hope we're going to get a good rate of return on some of these projects that we're investing in too. But we also feel that it's important for us to start putting money back into sustainability and building out this nascent market that needs more financial backing, whether it's green bonds or buying forwards. Google, Microsoft, there's a lot of other large tech companies that are starting to allocate billions of dollars into this space. How do you think your project's going to help companies like Ripple invest in sustainability?
I'm not sure about that. I think one thing that could be useful with understanding how different companies and how serious they are about their internal carbon pricing mechanisms could be a signal for, you know, how successful they might be in decarbonizing. And so if that can be tracked transparently in a way that's actionable, I think that could be useful for an investor's point of view who's really focused on sustainability and making sure that the companies in their portfolio are also serious about it instead of relying on empty pledges. That's on one side of things. I think the other side of things is, you know, DLTs in general and more sustainable blockchains can be used in what we call the MRV process, the monitoring, reporting, and verification process. So there is something called the Biodiversity Credit Alliance now, which is created by the United Nations and it's got a whole lot of members. And one of the things they're trying to do is use DLTs to transparently store and track all of this biodiversity information. You know, Peter, like you were saying, you know, you have these microphones hanging around in the tropical rainforest to record bird calls. Where does all that data go? How do you process the data? How do you audit it and make sure that, you know, A, the algorithms that are doing the job are not lying, they're not inefficient, they're recording the data that can then not be manipulated, they should not be double counted, blah, blah, blah. There's stuff at different levels of the stack that need to be made more and more robust. And I think DLTs will play a large role in this, whether it's in the carbon, the biodiversity, or any of these green financing mechanisms that requires a lot of monitoring, reporting, and verification. The technology can be used, and maybe some of the things that are being built by the technology can be used by these companies and organizations. So perhaps that's the way.
We've covered a lot today. A little overwhelmed by everything we've talked about. Well, last tip for our listeners, how do you keep up? What are your favorite podcasts or websites? What do you go to?
Oh my God, it's a mess. There's just so much out there, right? I do most of my reading on scholar.google.com because I read a lot of academic papers. And I read this book called The Ministry for the Future by Kim Stanley Robinson. It's very popular by now.
It's a classic. Everybody should read that book.
Yeah, it's a classic by now, right? And it's not all doom and gloom, because it's really like, how can we rise to the challenge? The reality behind everything. There's the idea of the carbon coin in there, which is very fascinating. And that kind of put this idea in my head, okay, I need to switch gears. And that's how I ended up going to Berkeley and starting a PhD program. So highly recommend that.
Well, great. Thank you so much.
It's so encouraging to learn of these new business models and applications of technology addressing the climate crisis. Ondo is helping to build a world where our planet's global commons are better monitored and taken care of. Ondo, thanks for taking the time out of your day to share your mission and for visiting us in person to record this episode of All About Blockchain.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me. It's been lovely.
And listeners, we're so thankful for your attention and appreciate your comments on my LinkedIn and feedback to Ubri@ripple.com. Until next time.